Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Section 20 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier bore himself at Waterloo. The story of the 9 Prussian horsemen. I told you when last we met, my friends, of the important mission from the Emperor to Marshal Grouchy, which failed through no fault of my own. And I described to you how during a long afternoon I was shut up in the attic of a country inn and was prevented from coming out because the Prussians were all around me. You will remember also how I overheard the chief of the Prussian staff give his instructions to Count Stein and so learned the dangerous plan which was on foot to kill or capture the Emperor in the event of a French defeat. At first I could not have believed in such a thing, but since the guns had thundered all day, and since the sound had made no advance in my direction, it was evident that the English had at least held their own and beaten off all our attacks. I have said that it was a fight that day between the soul of France and the beef of England, but it must be confessed that we found the beef was very tough. It was clear that if the Emperor could not defeat the English when alone, then it might indeed go hard with him, now that 60,000 of these cursed Prussians were swarming on his flank. In any case, with this secret in my possession, my place was by his side. I had made my way out of the inn in the dashing manner which I have described to you when last we met, and I left the English aide-de-camp, shaking his foolish fist out of the window. I could not but laugh as I looked back on him, for his angry red face was framed and frilled with hay. Once out on the road, I stood erect in my stirrups, and I put on the handsome black riding coat, lined with red, which had belonged to him. It fell to the top of my high boots and covered my tell-tale uniform completely. As to my busby, there are many such in the German service, and there was no reason why it should attract attention. So long as no one spoke to me, there was no reason why I should not ride through the whole of the Prussian army. But though I understood German, for I had many friends among the German ladies during the pleasant years that I fought all over that country, still I spoke it with a pretty Parisian accent, which could not be confounded with their rough, unmusical speech. I knew that this quality of my accent would attract attention, but I could only hope and pray that I would be permitted to go my way in silence. The forest of Paris was so large that it was useless to think of going round it, and so I took my courage in both hands and galloped on down the road in the track of the Prussian army. It was not hard to trace it, for it was rutted 2 feet deep by the gun wheels and the caissons. Soon I found a fringe of wounded men, Prussians and French, on each side of it, where Bulov's advance had come into touch with Marbot's hussars. One old man with a long white beard, a surgeon, I suppose, shouted at me and ran after me, still shouting, but I never turned my head and took no notice of him, save to spur on faster. I heard his shouts long after I had lost sight of him among the trees. Presently I came up with the Prussian reserves. The infantry were leaning on their muskets, or lying exhausted on the wet ground, and the officers stood in groups, listening to the mighty roar of the battle and discussing the reports which came from the front. I hurried past at the top of my speed, but one of them rushed out and stood in my path with his hand up as a signal to me to stop. 5,000 Prussian eyes were turned upon me. There was a moment. You turn pale, my friends, at the thought of it. Think how every hair upon me stood on end. But never for one instant did my wits or my courage desert me. "General Blucher," I cried. Was it not my guardian angel who whispered the words in my ear? The Prussian sprang from my path, saluted and pointed forward. They are well disciplined, these Prussians, and who was he that he should dare to stop the officer who bore a message to the general? It was a talisman that would pass me out of every danger, and my heart sang within me at the thought. So elated was I that I no longer waited to be asked, but as I rode through the army, I shouted to right and left, "General Blucher! General Blucher!" And every man pointed me onward and cleared a path to let me pass. There are times when the most supreme impudence is the highest wisdom, but discretion must also be used, and I must admit that I became indiscreet. For as I rode upon my way, ever nearer to the fighting line, a Prussian officer of Uhlans gripped my bridle and pointed to a group of men who stood near a burning farm. "There is Marshal Blucher. Deliver your message," said he, and sure enough my terrible old grey-whiskered veteran was there, within a pistol-shot, his eyes turned in my direction. But the good guardian angel did not desert me. Quick as a flash there came into my memory the name of the general who commanded the advance of the Prussians. "General Bulov," I cried. The Uhlan let go my bridle. "General Bulov! General Bulov!" I shouted, as every stride of the dear little mare took me nearer my own people. Through the burning village of Planchenoit I galloped, spurred my way between two columns of Prussian infantry, sprang over a hedge, cut down a Silesian hussar who flung himself before me, and an instant afterward, with my coat flying open to show the uniform below, I passed through the open files of the 10th of the line and was back in the heart of Lobau's corps once more. Outnumbered and outflanked, they were being slowly driven in by the pressure of the Prussian advance. I galloped onward, anxious only to find myself by the Emperor's side. But a sight lay before me which held me fast as though I had been turned into some noble equestrian statue. I could not move, I could scarce breathe, as I gazed upon it. There was a mound over which my path lay, and as I came out on the top of it, I looked down the long, shallow valley of Waterloo. I had left it with two great armies on either side and a clear field between them. Now there were but long, ragged fringes of broken and exhausted regiments upon the two ridges, but a real army of dead and wounded lay between. For 2 miles in length and half a mile across the ground was strewed and heaped with them. But slaughter was no new sight to me, and it was not that which held me spellbound. It was that up the long slope of the British position was moving a walking forest, black, tossing, waving, unbroken. Did I not know the bearskins of the guard? And did I not also know, did not my soldier's instinct tell me, that it was the last reserve of France, that the Emperor, like a desperate gamester, was staking all upon his last card? Up they went, and up, grand, solid, unbreakable, scourged with musketry, riddled with grape, flowing onward in a black heavy tide which lapped over the British batteries. With my glass I could see the English gunners throw themselves under their pieces or run to the rear. On rolled the crest of the bearskins, and then with a crash which was swept across to my ears they met the British infantry. A minute passed, and another, my heart was in my mouth. They swayed back and forward, they no longer advanced. They were held. Great heaven, was it possible that they were breaking? One black dot ran down the hill, then two, then four, then ten, then a great scattered, struggling mass, halting, breaking, halting, and at last shredding out and rushing madly downward. "The guard is beaten! The guard is beaten!" From all around me I heard the cry. Along the whole line the infantry turned their faces and the gunners flinched from their guns. "The old guard is beaten! The guard retreats!" An officer with a livid face passed me yelling out these words of woe. "Save yourselves! Save yourselves! You are betrayed!" cried another. "Save yourselves! Save yourselves!" Men were rushing madly to the rear, blundering and jumping like frightened sheep. Cries and screams rose from all around me, and at that moment, as I looked at the British position, I saw what I can never forget. A single horseman stood out black and clear upon the ridge against the last red, angry glow of the setting sun. So dark, so motionless against that grim light, he might have been the very spirit of battle brooding over that terrible valley. As I gazed, he raised his hat high in the air, and at the signal, with a low, deep roar like a breaking wave, the whole British army flooded over the ridge and came rolling down into the valley. Long, steel-fringed lines of red and blue, sweeping waves of cavalry, horse batteries rattling and bounding, down they came onto our crumbling ranks. It was over. A yell of agony, the agony of brave men who see no hope, rose from one flank to the other, and in an instant the whole of that noble army was swept in a wild, terror-stricken crowd from the field. Even now, dear friends, I cannot, as you see, speak of that dreadful moment with a dry eye or with a steady voice. At first I was carried away in that wild rush, whirled off like a straw in a flooded gutter. But suddenly, what should I see amongst the mixed regiments in front of me but a group of stern horsemen in silver and grey, with a broken and tattered standard held aloft in the heart of them. Not all the might of England and of Prussia could break the hussars of Conflans. But when I joined them, it made my heart bleed to see them. The major, 7 captains, and 500 men were left upon the field. Young Captain Sabatier was in command, and when I asked him where were the 5 missing squadrons, he pointed back and answered, "You will find them round one of those British squares." Men and horses were at their last gasp, caked with sweat and dirt, their black tongues hanging out from their lips. But it made me thrill with pride to see how that shattered remnant still rode knee to knee, with every man, from the boy trumpeter to the farrier sergeant, in his own proper place. Would that I could have brought them on with me as an escort for the Emperor. In the heart of the hussars of Conflans he would be safe indeed, but the horses were too spent to trot. I left them behind me, with orders to rally upon the farmhouse of Saint-Aunay, where we had camped 2 nights before. For my own part, I forced my horse through the throng in search of the Emperor. There were things which I saw then, as I pressed through that dreadful crowd, which can never be banished from my mind. In evil dreams there comes back to me the memory of that flowing stream of livid, staring, screaming faces upon which I looked down. It was a nightmare. In victory, one does not understand the horror of war. It is only in the cold chill of defeat that it is brought home to you. I remember an old grenadier of the guard lying at the side of the road with his broken leg doubled at a right angle. "Comrades, comrades, keep off my leg," he cried, but they tripped and stumbled over him all the same. In front of me rode a lancer officer without his coat. His arm had just been taken off in the ambulance. The bandages had fallen. It was horrible. 2 gunners tried to drive through with their gun. A chasseur raised his musket and shot one of them through the head. I saw a major of cuirassiers draw his 2 holster pistols and shoot first his horse and then himself. Beside the road, a man in a blue coat was raging and raving like a madman. His face was black with powder. His clothes were torn. 1 epaulette was gone. The other hung dangling over his breast. Only when I came close to him did I recognize it was Marshal Ney. He howled at the flying troops, and his voice was hardly human. Then he raised the stump of his sword. It was broken 3 inches from the hilt. "Come and see how a Marshal of France can die!" he cried. Gladly would I have gone with him, but my duty lay elsewhere. He did not, as you know, find the death he sought, but he met it a few weeks later, in cold blood, at the hands of his enemies. There is an old proverb that in attack the French are more than men, in defeat they are less than women. I knew that it was true that day. But even in that rout I saw things which I can tell with pride. Through the fields which skirt the road move Cambronne's 3 reserve battalions of the Guard, the cream of our army. They walked slowly in square, their colours waving over the sombre line of the bearskins. All round them raged the English cavalry and the black lancers of Brunswick, wave after wave thundering up, breaking with a crash and recoiling in ruin. When last I saw them, the English guns, 6 at a time, were smashing grapeshot through their ranks, and the English infantry were closing in upon 3 sides and pouring volleys into them. But still, like a noble lion with fierce hounds clinging to its flanks, the glorious remnant of the Guard, marching slowly, halting, closing up, dressing, moved majestically from their last battle. Behind them the Guard's battery of 12-pounders was drawn up upon the ridge. Every gunner was in his place, but no gun fired. "Why do you not fire?" I asked the colonel as I passed. "Our powder is finished." "Then why not retire?" "Our appearance may hold them back for a little. We must give the Emperor time to escape." Such were the soldiers of France. Behind this screen of brave men, the others took their breath and then went on in less desperate fashion. They had broken away from the road, and all over the countryside in the twilight I could see the timid, scattered, frightened crowd who 10 hours before had formed the finest army that ever went down to battle. I, with my splendid mare, was soon able to get clear of the throng, and just after I passed Genappe I overtook the Emperor with the remains of his staff. Soult was with him still, and so were Drouot, Lobau, and Bertrand, with 5 chasseurs of the Guard, their horses hardly able to move. The night was falling, and the Emperor's haggard face gleamed white through the gloom as he turned it towards me. "Who is that?" he asked.
"Is Colonel Gerard," said Soult.
"Have you seen Marshal Grouchy?"
"No, sire. The Prussians were between." "Does not matter. Nothing matters now. Soult, I will go back."
He tried to turn his horse, but Bertrand seized his bridle.
"Ah, sire," said Soult, "the enemy has had good fortune enough already."
They forced him on among them. He rode in silence, with his chin upon his breast, the greatest and the saddest of men. Far away behind us, those remorseless guns were still roaring. Sometimes, out of the darkness would come shrieks and screams and the low thunder of galloping hoofs. At the sound, we would spur our horses and hasten onward through the scattered troops. At last, after riding all night in the clear moonlight, we found that we had left both pursued and pursuers behind. By the time we passed over the bridge at Charleroi, the dawn was breaking. What a company of spectres we looked in that cold, clear, searching light. The Emperor with his face of wax, Soult blotched with powder, Lobau dabbled with blood. But we rode more easily now and had ceased to glance over our shoulders, for Waterloo was more than 30 miles behind us. One of the Emperor's carriages had been picked up at Charleroi, and we halted now on the other side of the Sambre and dismounted from our horses. You will ask me why it was that during all this time I had said nothing of that which was nearest my heart, the need for guarding the Emperor. As a fact, I had tried to speak of it, both to Soult and to Lobau, but their minds were so overwhelmed with the disaster and so distracted by the pressing needs of the moment that it was impossible to make them understand how urgent was my message. Besides, during this long flight, we had always had numbers of French fugitives beside us on the road, and however demoralized they might be, we had nothing to fear from the attack of 9 men. But now, as we stood round the Emperor's carriage in the early morning, I observed with anxiety that not a single French soldier was to be seen upon the long white road behind us. We had outstripped the army. I looked round to see what means of defence were left to us. The horses of the chasseurs of the guard had broken down, and only one of them, a grey-whiskered sergeant, remained. There were Soult, Lobau, and Bertrand, but for all their talents, I had rather, when it came to hard knocks, have a single quartermaster sergeant of hussars at my side than the 3 of them put together. There remained the Emperor himself, the coachman, and a valet of the household who had joined us at Charleroi, 8 all told. But of the 8, only 2, the chasseur and I, were fighting soldiers who could be depended upon at a pinch. A chill came over me as I reflected how utterly helpless we were. At that moment I raised my eyes, and there were the 9 Prussian horsemen coming over the hill. End of section 20. Section 21 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier bore himself at Waterloo. The Story of the 9 Prussian Horsemen. Continued. On either side of the road at this point are long stretches of rolling plain, part of it yellow with corn, and part of it rich grassland watered by the Sambre. To the south of us was a low ridge, over which was the road to France. Along this road the little group of cavalry was riding. So well had Count Stein obeyed his instructions that he had struck far to the south of us in his determination to get ahead of the Emperor. Now he was riding from the direction in which we were going, the last in which we could expect an enemy. When I caught that first glimpse of them, they were still 1/2 mile away. "Sire," I cried, "the Prussians!" They all started and stared. It was the Emperor who broke the silence. "Who says they are Prussians?" "I do, sire. I, Etienne Gerard." Unpleasant news always made the Emperor furious against the man who broke it. He railed at me now in the rasping, croaking, Corsican voice which only made itself heard when he had lost his self-control. "You are always a buffoon," he cried. "What do you mean, you numbskull, by saying that they are Prussians? How could Prussians be coming from the direction of France? You have lost any wits that you ever possessed." His words cut me like a whip, and yet we all felt towards the Emperor as an old dog does to its master. His kick is soon forgotten and forgiven. I would not argue or justify myself. At the first glance I had seen the 2 white stockings on the forelegs of the leading horse, and I knew well that Count Stein was on its back. For an instant the 9 horsemen had halted and surveyed us. Now they put spurs to their horses, and with a yell of triumph they galloped down the road. They had recognised that their prey was in their power. At that swift advance all doubt had vanished. "By heavens, sire, it is indeed the Prussians," cried Soult. Lobau and Bertrand ran about the road like 2 frightened hens. The sergeant of chasseurs drew his sabre with a volley of curses. The coachman and the valet cried and wrung their hands. Napoleon stood with a frozen face, 1 foot on the step of the carriage, and I was magnificent. What words can I use to do justice to my own bearing at that supreme instant of my life? So coldly alert, so deadly cool, so clear in brain and ready in hand, he had called me a numbskull and a buffoon. How quick and how noble was my revenge. When his own wits failed him, it was Etienne Gerard who supplied the want. To fight was absurd. To fly was ridiculous. The Emperor was stout and weary to death. At the best, he was never a good rider. How could he fly from these, the picked men of an army? The best horseman in Prussia was among them. But I was the best horseman in France. I, and only I, could hold my own with them. If they were on my track, instead of the Emperor's, all might still be well. These were the thoughts which flashed so swiftly through my mind that in an instant I had sprung from the first idea to the final conclusion. A Another instant carried me from the final conclusion to prompt and vigorous action. I rushed to the side of the Emperor, who stood petrified with the carriage between him and our enemies. "Your coat, sire! Your hat!" I cried. I dragged them off him. Never had he been so hustled in his life. In an instant I had them on and had thrust him into the carriage. The next I had sprung on to his famous white Arab and had ridden clear of the group upon the road. You have already divined my plan, but you may well ask, how could I hope to pass myself off as the Emperor? My figure is as you still see it, and his was never beautiful, for he was both short and stout. But a man's height is not remarked when he is in the saddle, and for the rest one had but to sit forward on the horse and round one's back and carry oneself like a sack of flour. I wore the little cocked hat and the loose grey coat with the silver star which was known to every child from one end of the Europe to the other. Beneath me was the Emperor's own famous white charger. It was complete. Already, as I rode clear, the Prussians were within 200 yards of us. I made a gesture of terror and despair with my hands, and I sprang my horse over the bank which lined the road. It was enough. A yell of exultation and of furious hatred broke from the Prussians. It was the howl of starving wolves who scent their prey. I spurred my horse over the meadowland and looked back under my arm as I rode. Oh, the glorious moment when, one after the other, I saw 8 horsemen come over the bank at my heels. Only one had stayed behind, and I heard shouting and the sounds of a struggle. I remembered my old sergeant of chasseurs, and I was sure that number 9 would trouble us no more. The road was clear, and the Emperor free to continue his journey. But now I had to think of myself. If I were overtaken, the Prussians would certainly make short work of me in their disappointment. If it were so, if I lost my life, I should still have sold it at a glorious price. But I had hopes that I might shake them off. With ordinary horsemen upon ordinary horses, I should have had no difficulty in doing so. But here both steeds and riders were of the best. It was a grand creature that I rode, but it was weary with its long night's work, and the Emperor was one of those riders who do not know how to manage a horse. He had little thought for them, and a heavy hand upon their mouths. On the other hand, Stein and his men had come both far and fast. The race was a fair one. So quick had been my impulse, and so rapidly had I acted upon it, that I had not thought enough of my own safety. Had I done so in the first instance, I should, of course, have ridden straight back the way we had come, for so I should have met our own people. But I was off the road and had galloped a mile over the plain before this occurred to me. Then, when I looked back, I saw that the Prussians had spread out into a long line so as to head me off from the Charleroi road. I could not turn back, but at least I could edge toward the north. I knew that the whole face of the country was covered with our flying troops, and that sooner or later I must come upon some of them. But one thing I had forgotten, the sombre. In my excitement, I never gave it a thought until I saw it, deep and broad, gleaming in the morning sunlight. It barred my path, and the Prussians howled behind me. I galloped to the brink, but the horse refused the plunge. I spurred him, but the bank was high and the stream deep. He shrank back, trembling and snorting. The yells of triumph were louder every instant. I turned and rode for my life down the river bank. It formed a loop at this part, and I must get across somehow, for my retreat was blocked. Suddenly a thrill of hope ran through me, for I saw a house on my side of the stream and another on the farther bank. Where there are 2 such houses, it usually means that there is a ford between them. A sloping path led to the brink, and I urged my horse down it. On he went, the water up to the saddle, the foam flying right and left. He blundered once, and I thought we were lost. But he recovered, and an instant later was clattering up the farther slope. As we came out, I heard the splash behind me, as the first Prussian took the water. There was just the breadth of the Somme between us. I rode with my head sunk between my shoulders, in Napoleon's fashion, and I did not dare to look back, for fear they should see my moustache. I had turned up the collar of the grey coat, so as partly to hide it. Even now, if they found out their mistake, they might turn and overtake the carriage. But when once we were on the road, I could tell by the drumming of their hoofs how far distant they were, and it seemed to me that the sound grew perceptibly louder, as if they were slowly gaining upon me. We were riding now up the stony and rutted lane which led from the ford. I peeped back very cautiously from under my arm, and I perceived that my danger came from a single rider who was far ahead of his comrades. He was a hussar, a very tiny fellow, upon a big black horse, and it was his light weight which had brought him into the foremost place. It is a place of honour, but it is also a place of danger, as he was soon to learn. I felt the holsters, but to my horror there were no pistols. There was a field glass in one, and the other was stuffed with papers. My sword had been left behind with Violette. Had I only my own weapons and my own little mare, I could have played with these rascals. But I was not entirely unarmed. The Emperor's own sword hung to the saddle. It was curved and short, the hilt all crusted with gold, a thing more fitted to glitter at a review than to serve a soldier in his deadly need. I drew it such as it was, and I waited my chance. Every instant the clink and clatter of the hoofs grew nearer. I heard the panting of the horse, and the fellow shouted some threat at me. There was a turn in the lane, and as I rounded it I drew up my white Arab on his haunches. As we spun round I met the Prussian hussar face to face. He was going too fast to stop, and his only chance was to ride me down. Had he done so, he might have met his own death, but he would have injured me or my horse past all hope of escape. But the fool flinched as he saw me waiting, and flew past me on my right. I lunged over my Arab's neck and buried my toy sword in his side. It must have been the finest steel and as sharp as a razor, for I hardly felt it enter, and yet his blood was within 3 inches of the hilt. His horse galloped on, and he kept his saddle for 100 yards before he sank down, with his face on the mane, and then dived over the side of the neck onto the road. For my own part, I was already at his horse's heels. A few seconds had sufficed for all that I have told. I heard the cry of rage and vengeance which rose from the Prussians as they passed their dead comrade, and I could not but smile as I wondered what they could think of the Emperor as a horseman and a swordsman. I glanced back cautiously as before, and I saw that none of the 7 men stopped. The fate of their comrade was nothing compared to the carrying out of their mission. They were as untiring and as remorseless as bloodhounds. But I had a good lead, and the brave Arab was still going well. I thought that I was safe, and yet it was at that very instant that the most terrible danger befell me. The lane divided, and I took the smaller of the 2 divisions, because it was the more grassy and the easier for the horse's hooves. Imagine my horror when, riding through a gate, I found myself in a square of stables and farm buildings, with no way out save that by which I had come. Ah, my friends, if my hair is snowy white, have I not had enough to make it so? To retreat was impossible. I could hear the thunder of the Prussians' hoofs in the lane. I looked round me, and nature has blessed me with that quick eye which is the first of gifts to any soldier, but most of all to a leader of cavalry. Between a long, low line of stables and the farmhouse, there was a pigsty. Its front was made of bars of wood, 4 feet high. The back was of stone, higher than the front. What was beyond, I could not tell. The space between the front and the back was not more than a few yards. It was a desperate venture, and yet I must take it. Every instant the beating of those hurrying hoofs was louder and louder. I put my Arab at the pigsty. She cleared the front beautifully, and came down with her 4 feet upon the sleeping pig within, slipping forward upon her knees. I was thrown over the wall beyond, and fell upon my hands and face in the soft flower-bed. My horse was upon one side of the wall, I upon the other, and the Prussians were pouring into the yard. But I was up in an instant, and had seized the bridle of the plunging horse over the top of the wall. It was built of loose stones, and I dragged down a few of them to make a gap. As I tugged at the bridle and shouted, the gallant creature rose to the leap, and an instant afterward she was by my side, and I with my foot on the stirrup. An heroic idea had entered my mind as I mounted into the saddle. These Prussians, if they came over the pigsty, could only come one at once, and their attack would not be formidable when they had not had time to recover from such a leap. Why should I not wait and kill them one by one as they came over? It was a glorious thought. They would learn that Etienne Gerard was not a safe man to hunt. My hand felt for my sword, but you can imagine my feelings, my friends, when I came upon an empty scabbard. It had been shaken out when the horse had tripped over that infernal pig. On what absurd trifles do our destinies hang? A pig on one side, Etienne Gerard on the other. Could I spring over the wall and get the sword? Impossible. The Prussians were already in the yard. I turned my Arab and resumed my flight. But for a moment it seemed to me that I was in a far worse trap than before. I found myself in the garden of the farmhouse, an orchard in the centre and flower beds all round. A high wall surrounded the whole place. I reflected, however, that there must be some point of entrance, since every visitor could not be expected to spring over the pigsty. I rode round the wall. As I expected, I came upon a door with a key upon the inner side. I dismounted, unlocked it, opened it, and there was a Prussian lancer sitting his horse within 6 feet of me. End of section 21. Section 22 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. How the Brigadier Bore Himself at Waterloo. The Story of the Nine Prussian Horsemen. Continued. For a moment we each stared at the other. Then I shut the door and locked it again. A crash and a cry came from the other end of the garden. I understood that one of my enemies had come to grief in trying to get over the pigsty. How could I ever get out of this cul-de-sac? It was evident that some of the party had galloped round, while some had followed straight upon my tracks. Had I my sword, I might have beaten off the lancer at the door, but to come out now was to be butchered. And yet, if I waited, some of them would certainly follow me on foot over the pigsty, and what could I do then? I must act at once, or I was lost. But it is at such moments that my wits are most active and my actions most prompt. Still leading my horse, I ran for 100 yards by the side of the wall, away from the spot where the lancer was watching. There I stopped, and with an effort I tumbled down several of the loose stones from the top of the wall. The instant I had done so, I hurried back to the door. As I had expected, he thought I was making a gap for my escape at that point, and I heard the thud of his horse's hoofs as he galloped to cut me off. As I reached the gate, I looked back, and I saw a green-coated horseman, whom I knew to be Count Stein, clear the pigsty and gallop furiously with a shout of triumph across the garden. "Surrender, Your Majesty, surrender!" he yelled. "We will give you quarter!" I slipped through the gate, but had no time to lock it on the other side. Stein was at my very heels, and the lancer had already turned his horse. Springing upon my Arab's back, I was off once more with a clear stretch of grassland before me. Stein had to dismount to open the gate, to lead his horse through, and to mount again before he could follow. It was he that I feared, rather than the lancer, whose horse was coarse-bred and weary. I galloped hard for a mile before I ventured to look back, and then Stein was a musket shot from me, and the lancer as much again, while only three of the others were in sight. My nine Prussians were coming down to more manageable numbers, and yet one was too much for an unarmed man. It had surprised me that during this long chase I had seen no fugitives from the army, but I reflected that I was considerably to the west of their line of flight, and that I must edge more towards the east if I wished to join them. Unless I did so, it was probable that my pursuers, even if they could not overtake me themselves, would keep me in view until I was headed off by some of their comrades coming from the north. As I looked to the eastward, I saw far off a line of dust which stretched for miles across the country. This was certainly the main road along which our unhappy army was flying. But I soon had proof that some of our stragglers had wandered into these side tracks, for I came suddenly upon a horse grazing at the corner of a field, and beside him, with his back against the bank, his master, a French cuirassier, terribly wounded and evidently on the point of death. I sprang down, seized his long heavy sword and rode on with it. Never shall I forget the poor man's face as he looked at me with his failing sight. He was an old grey-moustached soldier, one of the real fanatics, and to him this last vision of his emperor was like a revelation from on high. Astonishment, love, pride, all shone in his pallid face. He said something. I fear they were his last words. But I had no time to listen, and I galloped on my way. All this time I had been on the meadowland, which was intersected in this part by broad ditches. Some of them could not have been less than from 14 to 15 feet, and my heart was in my mouth as I went at each of them, for a slip would have been my ruin. But whoever selected the Emperor's horses had done his work well. The creature, save when it balked on the bank of the Sambre, never failed me for an instant. We cleared everything in one stride, and yet we could not shake off those infernal Prussians. As I left each watercourse behind me, I looked back with renewed hope, but it was only to see Stein on his white-legged chestnut flying over it as lightly as I had done myself. He was my enemy, but I honoured him for the way in which he carried himself that day. Again and again I measured the distance which separated him from the next horseman. I had the idea that I might turn and cut him down, as I had the hussar, before his comrade could come to his help. But the others had closed up and were not far behind. I reflected that this Stein was probably as fine a swordsman as he was a rider, and that it might take me some little time to get the better of him. In that case the others would come to his aid, and I should be lost. On the whole, it was wiser to continue my flight. A road with poplars on either side ran across the plain from east to west. It would lead me toward that long line of dust which marked the French retreat. I wheeled my horse, therefore, and galloped down it. As I rode, I saw a single house in front of me upon the right, with a great bush hung over the door to mark it as an inn. Outside there were several peasants, but for them I cared nothing. What frightened me was to see the gleam of a red coat, which showed that there were British in the place. However, I could not turn and I could not stop, so that there was nothing for it but to gallop on and to take my chance. There were no troops in sight, so these men must be stragglers or marauders, from whom I had little to fear. As I approached, I saw that there were two of them sitting drinking on a bench outside the inn door. I saw them stagger to their feet, and it was evident that they were both very drunk. One stood swaying in the middle of the road. "It's Boney! So help me, it's Boney!" he yelled. He ran with his hands out to catch me, but luckily for himself his drunken feet stumbled, and he fell on his face on the road. The other was more dangerous. He had rushed into the inn, and just as I passed, I saw him run out with his musket in his hand. He dropped upon one knee, and I stooped forward over my horse's neck. A single shot from a Prussian or an Austrian is a small matter, but the British were at that time the best shots in Europe, and my drunkard seemed steady enough when he had a gun at his shoulder. I heard the crack, and my horse gave a convulsive spring which would have unseated many a rider. For an instant I thought he was killed, but when I turned in my saddle, I saw a stream of blood running down the off hind quarter. I looked back at the Englishman, and the brute had bitten the end off another cartridge and was ramming it into his musket, but before he had it primed, we were beyond his range. These men were foot soldiers and could not join in the chase, but I heard them whooping and tally-hoeing behind me as if I had been a fox. The peasants also shouted and ran through the fields flourishing their sticks. From all sides I heard cries, and everywhere were the rushing, waving figures of my pursuers. To think of the great emperor being chivered over the countryside in this fashion! It made me long to have those rascals within the sweep of my sword. But now I felt that I was nearing the end of my course. I had done all that a man could be expected to do. Some would say more, but at last I had come to a point from which I could see no escape. The horses of my pursuers were exhausted, but mine was exhausted and wounded also. It was losing blood fast, and we left a red trail upon the white, dusty road. Already his pace was slackening, as sooner or later he must drop under me. I looked back, and there were the five inevitable Prussians, Stein 100 yards in front, then a lancer, and then three others riding together. Stein had drawn his sword, and he waved it at me. For my own part, I was determined not to give myself up. I would try how many of these Prussians I could take with me into the other world. At this supreme moment, all the great deeds of my life rose in a vision before me, and I felt that this, my last exploit, was indeed a worthy close to such a career. My death would be a fatal blow to those who loved me, to my dear mother, to my hussars, to others who shall be nameless. But all of them had my honour and my fame at heart, and I felt that their grief would be tinged with pride when they learned how I had ridden and how I had fought upon this last day. Therefore I hardened my heart, and as my Arab limped more and more upon his wounded leg, I drew the great sword which I had taken from the cuirassier, and I set my teeth for my supreme struggle. My hand was in the very act of tightening the bridle, for I feared that if I delayed longer, I might find myself on foot fighting against five mounted men. At that instant my eye fell upon something which brought hope to my heart and a shout of joy to my lips. From a grove of trees in front of me there projected the steeple of a village church. But there could not be two steeples like that, for the corner of it had crumbled away or been struck by lightning, so that it was of a most fantastic shape. I had seen it only 2 days before, and it was the church of the village of Gosselet. It was not the hope of reaching the village which set my heart singing with joy, but it was that I knew my ground now, and that farmhouse not half a mile ahead, with its gable end sticking out from amid the trees, must be that very farm of St. Arnay, where we had bivouacked, and which I had named Captain Sabatier as the rendezvous of the Hussars of Conflans. There they were, my little rascals, if I could but reach them. With every bound my horse grew weaker. Each instant the sound of the pursuit grew louder. I heard a gust of crackling German oaths at my very heels. A pistol bullet sighed in my ears. Spurring frantically and beating my poor Arab with the flat of my sword, I kept him at the top of his speed. The open gate of the farmyard lay before me. I saw the twinkle of steel within. Stein's horse's head was within 10 yards of me as I thundered through. "To me, comrades, to me!" I yelled. I heard a buzz as when the angry bees swarm from their nest. Then my splendid white Arab fell dead under me, and I was hurled onto the cobblestones of the yard, where I can remember no more. Such was my last and most famous exploit, my dear friends, a story which ran through Europe and has made the name of Etienne Gerard famous in history. Alas that all my efforts could only give the Emperor a few weeks more liberty, since he surrendered upon the 15th of July to the English. But it was not my fault that he was not able to collect the forces still waiting for him in France and to fight another Waterloo with a happier ending. Had others been as loyal as I was, the history of the world might have been changed. The Emperor would have preserved his throne, and such a soldier as I would not have been left to spend his life in planting cabbages or to while away his old age telling stories in a cafe. You ask me about the fate of Stein and the Prussian horsemen? Of the three who dropped upon the way, I know nothing. One you will remember that I killed. There remained five, three of whom were cut down by my hussars, who, for the instant, were under the impression that it was indeed the Emperor whom they were defending. Stein was taken, slightly wounded, and so was one of the Uhlans. The truth was not told to them, for we thought it best that no news, or false news, should get about as to where the Emperor was, so that Count Stein still believed that he was within a few yards of making that tremendous capture. "You may well love and honour your Emperor," said he, "for such a horseman and such a swordsman I have never seen." He could not understand why the young colonel of hussars laughed so heartily at his words, but he has learned since. End of section 22. An end of how the brigadier bore himself at Waterloo. The story of the 9 Prussian horsemen. Section 23 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Last Adventure of the Brigadier. I will tell you no more stories, my dear friends. It is said that man is like the hare, which runs in a circle and comes back to die at the point from which it started. Gascony has been calling to me of late. I see the blue Garonne winding among the vineyards and the bluer ocean toward which its waters sweep. I see the old town also, and the bristle of masts from the side of the long stone quay. My heart hungers for the breath of my native air and the warm glow of my native sun. Here in Paris are my friends, my occupations, my pleasures. There all who have known me are in their grave. And yet the southwest wind, as it rattles on my windows, seems always to be the strong voice of the motherland, calling her child back to that bosom into which I am ready to sink. I have played my part in my time. The time has passed. I must pass also. Nay, dear friends, do not look sad, for what can be happier than a life completed in honour and made beautiful with friendship and love? And yet it is solemn also when a man approaches the end of the long road and sees the turning which leads him into the unknown. But the Emperor and all his marshals have ridden round that dark turning and passed into the beyond. My hussars, too, there are not 50 men who are not waiting yonder. I must go. But on this, the last night, I will tell you that which is more than a tale. It is a great historical secret. My lips have been sealed, but I see no reason why I should not leave behind me some account of this remarkable adventure, which must otherwise be entirely lost, since I, and only I, of all living men, have a knowledge of the facts. I will ask you to go back with me to the year 1821. In that year our great emperor had been absent from us for 6 years, and only now and then from over the seas we heard some whisper which showed that he was still alive. You cannot think what a weight it was upon our hearts for us who loved him to think of him in captivity, eating his giant soul out upon that lonely island. From the moment we rose until we closed our eyes in sleep, the thought was always with us, and we felt dishonoured that he, our chief and master, should be so humiliated without our being able to move a hand to help him. There were many who would most willingly have laid down the remainder of their lives to bring him a little ease, and yet all that we could do was to sit and grumble in our cafes and stare at the map, counting up the leagues of water which lay between us. It seemed that he might have been in the moon for all that we could do to help him, but that was only because we were all soldiers and knew nothing of the sea. Of course, we had our own little troubles to make us bitter, as well as the wrongs of our emperor. There were many of us who had held high rank, and would hold it again if he came back to his own. We had not found it possible to take service under the white flag of the Bourbons, or to take an oath which might turn our sabres against the man whom we loved. So we found ourselves with neither work nor money. What could we do save gather together and gossip and grumble, while those who had a little paid the score, and those who had nothing shared the bottle? Now and then, if we were lucky, we managed to pick a quarrel with one of the garde corps, and if we left him on his back in the bois, we felt that we had struck a blow for Napoleon once again. They came to know our haunts in time, and they avoided them as if they had been hornets' nests. There was one of these, the Sign of the Great Man, in the Rue Varennes, which was frequented by several of the more distinguished and younger Napoleonic officers. Nearly all of us had been colonels or aides-de-camp, and when any man of less distinction came among us, we generally made him feel that he had taken a liberty. There were Captain Lepine, who had won the Medal of Honour at Leipzig, Colonel Bonnet, aide-de-camp to MacDonald, Colonel Jourdan, whose fame in the army was hardly second to my own, Sabatier of my own hussars, Mounier of the Red Lancers, Le Breton of the Guards, and a dozen others. Every night we met and talked, played dominoes, drank a glass or two, and wondered how long it would be before the Emperor would be back, and we at the head of our regiments once more. The Bourbons had already lost any hold they ever had upon the country, as was shown a few years afterward, when Paris rose against them, and they were hunted for the third time out of France. Napoleon had but to show himself on the coast, and he would have marched without firing a musket to the capital, exactly as he had done when he came back from Elba. Well, when affairs were in this state, there arrived one night in February, in our café, a most singular little man. He was short, but exceedingly broad, with huge shoulders, and a head which was a deformity, so large was it. His heavy brown face was scarred with white streaks in a most extraordinary manner, and he had grizzled whiskers such as seamen wear. Two gold earrings in his ears and plentiful tattooing upon his hands and arms told us also that he was of the sea before he introduced himself to us as Captain Fourneau of the Emperor's Navy. He had letters of introduction to two of our number, and there could be no doubt that he was devoted to the cause. He won our respect, too, for he had seen as much fighting as any of us, and the burns upon his face were caused by his standing to his post upon the Orient at the Battle of the Nile until the vessel blew up underneath him. Yet he would say little about himself, but he sat in the corner of the café, watching us all with a wonderfully sharp pair of eyes, and listening intently to our talk. One night I was leaving the café when Captain Fourneau followed me, and touching me on the arm, he led me, without saying a word, for some distance until we reached his lodgings. "I wish to have a chat with you," said he, and so conducted me up the stair to his room. Then he lit a lamp and handed me a sheet of paper, which he took from an envelope in his bureau. It was dated a few months before from the Palace of Schönbrunn at Vienna. "Captain Fourneau is acting in the highest interests of the Emperor Napoleon. Those who love the Emperor should obey him without question. Marie Louise." That is what I read. I was familiar with the signature of the Empress, and I could not doubt that this was genuine. "Well," said he, "are you satisfied as to my credentials?"
"Entirely."
"Are you prepared to take your orders from me?"
"This document leaves me no choice."
"Good. In the first place, I understand, from something you said in the café, that you can speak English?"
"Yes, I can."
"Let me hear you do so."
I said in English, "Whenever the Emperor needs the help of Etienne Gerard, I am ready night and day to give my life in his service."
Captain Fourneau smiled. "It is funny English," said he, "but still it is better than no English. For my own part, I speak English like an Englishman. It is all that I have to show for 6 years spent in an English prison. Now, I will tell you why I have come to Paris. I have come in order to choose an agent who will help me in a matter which affects the interests of the Emperor. I was told that it was at the café of the great man that I would find the pick of his old officers, and that I could rely upon every man there being devoted to his interests. I studied you all, therefore, and I have come to the conclusion that you are the one who is most suited for my purpose." I acknowledged the compliment. "What is it that you wish me to do?" I asked.
"Merely to keep me company for a few months," said he. "You must know that after my release in England, I settled down there, married an English wife, and rose to command a small English merchant ship, in which I have made several voyages from Southampton to the Guinea coast. They look on me there as an Englishman. You can understand, however, that with my feelings about the Emperor, I am lonely sometimes, and that it would be an advantage to me to have a companion who would sympathize with my thoughts. One gets very bored on these long voyages, and I would make it worth your while to share my cabin."
He looked hard at me with his shrewd grey eyes all the time that he was uttering this rigmarole, and I gave him a glance in return which showed him that he was not dealing with a fool. He took out a canvas bag full of money. "There are £100 in gold in this bag," said he. "You will be able to buy some comforts for your voyage. I should recommend you to get them in Southampton, whence we will start in 10 days. The name of the vessel is the Black Swan. I return to Southampton tomorrow, and I shall hope to see you in the course of the next week."
"Come now," said I. "Tell me frankly, what is the destination of our voyage?"
"Oh, didn't I tell you?" he answered. "We are bound for the Guinea coast of Africa."
"Then how can that be in the highest interests of the Emperor?" I asked.
"It is in his highest interests that you ask no indiscreet questions and I give no indiscreet replies," he answered sharply. So he brought the interview to an end, and I found myself back in my lodgings with nothing save this bag of gold to show that this singular interview had indeed taken place. There was every reason why I should see the adventure to a conclusion, and so within a week I was on my way to England. I passed from St. Malo to Southampton, and on inquiry at the docks I had no difficulty in finding the Black Swan, a neat little vessel of a shape which is called, as I learned afterward, a brig. There was Captain Fourneau himself upon the deck, and 7 or 8 rough fellows hard at work, grooming her and making her ready for sea. He greeted me and led me down to his cabin. "You are plain Mr. Gerard now," said he, "and a Channel Islander. I would be obliged to you if you would kindly forget your military ways and drop your cavalry swagger when you walk up and down my deck. A beard, too, would seem more sailor-like than those moustaches." I was horrified by his words. But, after all, there are no ladies on the high seas, and what does it matter? He rang for the steward. "Gustave," said he, "you will pay every attention to my friend Monsieur Etienne Gerard, who makes this voyage with us. This is Gustave Kerouan, my Breton steward," he explained, "and you are very safe in his hands." The steward, with his harsh face and stern eyes, looked a very warlike person for so peaceful an employment. I said nothing, however, though you may guess that I kept my eyes open. A berth had been prepared for me next the cabin, which would have seemed comfortable enough had it not contrasted with the extraordinary splendour of Fourneau's quarters. He was certainly a most luxurious person, for his room was new fitted with velvet and silver in a way which would have suited the yacht of a noble better than a little West African trader. So thought the mate, Mr. Burns, who could not hide his amusement and contempt whenever he looked at it. This fellow, a big, solid, red-headed Englishman, had the other berth connected with the cabin. There was a second mate named Turner, who lodged in the middle of the ship, and there were 9 men and 1 boy in the crew, 3 of whom, as I was informed by Mr. Burns, were Channel Islanders like myself. This Burns, the first mate, was much interested to know why I was coming with them. "I come for pleasure," said I. He stared at me. "Ever been to the West Coast?" he asked. I said that I had not. "I thought not," said he. "You'll never come again for that reason, anyhow." Some 3 days after my arrival, we untied the ropes by which the ship was tethered, and we set off upon our journey. I was never a good sailor, and I may confess that we were far out of sight of any land before I was able to venture upon deck. At last, however, upon the 5th day, I drank the soup which the good Kerouan brought me, and I was able to crawl from my bunk and up the stair. The fresh air revived me, and from that time onward I accommodated myself to the motion of the vessel. My beard had begun to grow also, and I have no doubt that I should have made as fine a sailor as I have a soldier had I chanced to be born to that branch of the service. I learned to pull the ropes which hoisted the sails, and also to haul round the long sticks to which they are attached. For the most part, however, my duties were to play écarté with Captain Fourneau, and to act as his companion. It was not strange that he should need one, for neither of his mates could read or write, though each of them was an excellent seaman.
If our captain had died suddenly, I cannot imagine how we should have found our way in that waste of waters, for it was only he who had the knowledge which enabled him to mark our place upon the chart. He had this fixed upon the cabin wall, and every day he put our course upon it, so that we could see at a glance how far we were from our destination. It was wonderful how well he could calculate it, for one morning he said that we should see the Cap Verde light that very night, and there it was, sure enough, upon our left front, the moment that darkness came. Next day, however, the land was out of sight, and Burns, the mate, explained to me that we should see no more until we came to our port in the Gulf of Biafra. Every day we flew south with a favouring wind, and always at noon the pin upon the chart was moved nearer and nearer to the African coast. I may explain that palm oil was the cargo which we were in search of, and that our own lading consisted of coloured cloths, old muskets, and such other trifles as the English sell to the savages. End of section 23. Section 24 of The Adventures of Gerard. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Last Adventure of the Brigadier. Continued. At last the wind which had followed us so long died away, and for several days we drifted about on a calm and oily sea, under a sun which brought the pitch bubbling out between the planks upon the deck. We turned and turned our sails to catch every wandering puff, until at last we came out of this belt of calm and ran south again with a brisk breeze, the sea all round us being alive with flying fishes. For some days Burns appeared to be uneasy, and I observed him continually shading his eyes with his hands and staring at the horizon as if he were looking for land. Twice I caught him with his red head against the chart in the cabin, gazing at that pin which was always approaching and yet never reaching the African coast. At last, one evening, as Captain Fourneau and I were playing écarté in the cabin, the mate entered with an angry look upon his sunburned face. "I beg your pardon, Captain Fourneau," said he, "but do you know what course the man at the wheel is steering?" "Due south," the captain answered, with his eyes fixed upon his cards. "And he should be steering due east." "How do you make that out?" The mate gave an angry growl. "I may not have much education," said he, "but let me tell you this, Captain Fourneau. I've sailed these waters since I was a little nipper of 10, and I know the line when I'm on it, and I know the doldrums, and I know how to find my way to the oil rivers. We are south of the line now, and we should be steering due east instead of due south, if your port is the port that the owner sent you to."
"Excuse me, Mr. Gerard. Just remember that it is my lead," said the captain, laying down his cards. "Come to the map here, Mr. Burns, and I will give you a lesson in practical navigation. Here is the trade wind from the southwest, and here is the line, and here is the port that we want to make, and here is a man who will have his own way aboard his own ship." As he spoke, he seized the unfortunate mate by the throat and squeezed him until he was nearly senseless. Kerouan, the steward, had rushed in with a rope, and between them they gagged and trussed the man so that he was utterly helpless. "There is one of our Frenchmen at the wheel. We had best put the mate overboard," said the steward. "That is safest," said Captain Fourneau. But that was more than I could stand. Nothing would persuade me to agree to the death of a helpless man. With a bad grace, Captain Fourneau consented to spare him, and we carried him to the afterhold, which lay under the cabin. There he was laid among the bales of Manchester cloth. "It is not worth while to put down the hatch," said Captain Fourneau. "Gustave, go to Mr. Turner and tell him that I would like to have a word with him." The unsuspecting second mate entered the cabin and was instantly gagged and secured, as Burns had been. He was carried down and laid beside his comrade. The hatch was then replaced. "Our hands have been forced by the red-headed dolt," said the captain, "and I have had to explode my mind before I wished. However, there is no great harm done, and it will not seriously disarrange my plans.
Kerouan, you will take a keg of rum forward to the crew. Tell them that the captain gives it to them, to drink his health on the occasion of crossing the line. They will know no better. As to our own fellows, bring them down to your pantry, so that we may be sure that they are ready for business. Now, Colonel Gerard, with your permission we will resume our game of écarté. It is one of those occasions which one does not forget. This captain, who was a man of iron, shuffled and cut, dealt and played, as if he were in his café. From below we heard the inarticulate murmurings of the two mates, half smothered by the handkerchiefs which gagged them. Outside the timbers creaked and the sails hummed under the brisk breeze which was sweeping us upon our way. Amid the splash of the waves and the whistle of the wind, we heard the wild cheers and shoutings of the English sailors as they broached the keg of rum. We played half a dozen games, and then the captain rose. "I think they are ready for us now," said he. He took a brace of pistols from a locker, and he handed one of them to me. But we had no need to fear resistance, for there was no one to resist. The Englishman of those days, whether soldier or sailor, was an incorrigible drunkard. Without drink he was a brave and good man, but if drink were laid before him it was a perfect madness. Nothing could induce him to take it with moderation. In the dim light of the den which they inhabited, five senseless figures and two shouting, swearing, singing madmen represented the crew of the Black Swan. Coils of rope were brought forward by the steward, and with the help of two French seamen, the third was at the wheel, we secured the drunkards and tied them up, so that it was impossible for them to speak or move. They were placed under the forehatch, as their officers had been under the after one, and Kerouan was directed twice a day to give them food and drink. So at last we found that the Black Swan was entirely our own. Had there been bad weather, I do not know what we should have done, but we still went gaily upon our way, with a wind which was strong enough to drive us swiftly south, but not strong enough to cause us alarm. On the evening of the third day, I found Captain Fourneau gazing eagerly out from the platform in the front of the vessel. "Look, Gerard, look!" he cried, and pointed over the pole which stuck out in front. A light blue sky rose from a dark blue sea, and far away, at the point where they met, was a shadowy something, like a cloud, but more definite in shape. "What is it?" I cried. "It is land." "And what land?" I strained my ears for the answer, and yet I knew already what the answer would be. It is St. Helena. Here, then, was the island of my dreams. Here was the cage where our great eagle of France was confined. All those thousands of leagues of water had not sufficed to keep Gerard from the master whom he loved. There he was, there on that cloud bank, yonder over the dark blue sea. How my eyes devoured it! How my soul flew in front of the vessel, flew on and on, to tell him that he was not forgotten, that after many days one faithful servant was coming to his side. Every instant the dark blur upon the water grew harder and clearer. Soon I could see plainly enough that it was indeed a mountainous island. The night fell, but still I knelt upon the deck, with my eyes fixed upon the darkness which covered the spot where I knew that the great emperor was. An hour passed, and another one, and then, suddenly, a little golden twinkling light shone out exactly ahead of us. It was the light of the window of some house, perhaps of his house. It could not be more than a mile or two away. Oh, how I held out my hands to it! They were the hands of Etienne Gerard, but it was for all France that they were held out. Every light had been extinguished aboard our ship, and presently, at the direction of Captain Fourneau, we all pulled upon one of the ropes which had the effect of swinging round one of the sticks above us, and so stopping the vessel. Then he asked me to step down to the cabin. "You understand everything now, Colonel Gerard," said he, "and you will forgive me if I did not take you into my complete confidence before. It is a matter of such importance, I make no man my confidant. I have long planned the rescue of the Emperor, and my remaining in England and joining their merchant service was entirely with that design. All has worked out exactly as I expected. I have made several successful voyages to the west coast of Africa, so that there was no difficulty in my obtaining the command of this one. One by one, I got these old French man-of-war's men among the hands. As to you, I was anxious to have one tried fighting man in case of resistance, and I also desired to have a fitting companion for the Emperor during his long homeward voyage. My cabin is already fitted up for his use. I trust that before tomorrow morning he will be inside it, and we out of sight of this accursed island. You can think of my emotion, my friends, as I listened to these words. I embraced the brave Fourneau and implored him to tell me how I could assist him. "I must leave it all in your hands," said he. "Would that I could have been the first to pay him homage. But it would not be wise for me to go. The glass is falling, there is a storm brewing, and we have the land under our lee. Besides, there are three English cruisers near the island, which may be upon us at any moment. It is for me, therefore, to guard the ship, and for you to bring off the Emperor." I thrilled at the words. "Give me your instructions," I cried. "I can only spare you one man, for already I can hardly pull round the yards," said he. "One of the boats has been lowered, and this man will row you ashore and await your return. The light which you see is indeed the light of Longwood. All who are in the house are your friends, and all may be depended upon to aid the Emperor's escape. There is a cordon of English sentries, but they are not very near to the house. Once you have got as far as that, you will convey our plans to the Emperor, guide him down to the boat, and bring him on board." The Emperor himself could not have given his instructions more shortly and clearly. There was not a moment to be lost. The boat with the seaman was waiting alongside. I stepped into it, and an instant afterward we had pushed off. Our little boat danced over the dark waters, but always shining before my eyes was the light of Longwood, the light of the Emperor, the star of hope. Presently the bottom of the boat grated upon the pebbles of the beach. It was a deserted cove, and no challenge from a sentry came to disturb us. I left the seaman by the boat, and I began to climb the hillside. There was a goat track winding in and out among the rocks, so I had no difficulty in finding my way. It stands to reason that all paths in St. Helena would lead to the Emperor. I came to a gate, no sentry, and I passed through. Another gate, still no sentry. I wondered what had become of this cordon of which Fourneau had spoken. I had come now to the top of my climb, for there was the light burning steadily right in front of me. I concealed myself and took a good look round, but still I could see no sign of the enemy. As I approached, I saw the house, a long, low building with a veranda. A man was walking up and down upon the path in front. I crept nearer and had a look at him. Perhaps it was this cursed Hudson Lowe. What a triumph if I could not only rescue the Emperor, but also avenge him. But it was more likely that this man was an English sentry. I crept nearer still, and the man stopped in front of the lighted window, so that I could see him. No, it was no soldier, but a priest. I wondered what such a man could be doing here, at 2 in the morning. Was he French or English? If he were one of the household, I might take him into my confidence. If he were English, he might ruin all my plans. I crept a little nearer still, and at that moment he entered the house, a flood of light pouring out through the open door. All was clear for me now, and I understood that not an instant was to be lost. Bending myself double, I ran swiftly forward to the lighted window. Raising my head, I peeped through, and there was the Emperor, lying dead before me. My friends, I fell down upon the gravel walk as senseless as if a bullet had passed through my brain. So great was the shock that I wonder that I survived it. And yet, in half an hour, I had staggered to my feet again, shivering in every limb, my teeth chattering, and there I stood, staring with the eyes of a maniac into that room of death. He lay upon a bier in the centre of the chamber, calm, composed, majestic, his face full of that reserve power which lightened our hearts upon the day of battle. A half-smile was fixed upon his pale lips, and his eyes, half-opened, seemed to be turned on mine. He was stouter than when I had seen him at Waterloo, and there was a gentleness of expression which I had never seen in life. On either side of him burned rows of candles, and this was the beacon which had welcomed us at sea, which had guided me over the water, and which I had hailed as my star of hope. Dimly I became conscious that many people were kneeling in the room. The little court, men and women who had shared his fortunes, Bertrand, his wife, the priest, Montalon, all were there. I would have prayed too, but my heart was too heavy and bitter for prayer. And yet I must leave, and I could not leave him without a sign. Regardless of whether I was seen or not, I drew myself erect before my dead leader, brought my heels together, and raised my hand in a last salute. Then I turned and hurried off through the darkness, with the picture of the wan, smiling lips and the steady grey eyes dancing always before me. It had seemed to me but a little time that I had been away, and yet the boatman told me that it was hours. Only when he spoke of it did I observe that the wind was blowing half a gale from the sea, and that the waves were roaring in upon the beach. Twice we tried to push out our little boat, and twice it was thrown back by the sea. The third time a great wave filled it and stove the bottom. Helplessly we waited beside it until the dawn broke, to show a raging sea and a flying scud above it. There was no sign of the Black Swan. Climbing the hill we looked down, but on all the great torn expanse of the ocean there was no gleam of a sail. She was gone. Whether she had sunk, or whether she was recaptured by her English crew, or what strange fate may have been in store for her, I do not know. Never again in this life did I see Captain Fourneau to tell him the result of my mission. For my own part, I gave myself up to the English, my boatman and I pretending that we were the only survivors of a lost vessel, though indeed there was no pretense in the matter. At the hands of their officers I received the generous hospitality which I have always encountered. But it was many a long month before I could get a passage back to the dear land, outside of which there can be no happiness for so true a Frenchman as myself. And so I tell you in one evening how I bade good-bye to my master, and I take my leave also of you, my kind friends, who have listened so patiently to the long-winded stories of an old broken soldier. Russia, Italy, Germany, Spain, Portugal, and England, you have gone with me to all these countries, and you have seen through my dim eyes something of the sparkle and splendour of those great days. And I have brought back to you some shadow of those men whose tread shook the earth. Treasure it in your minds, and pass it on to your children, for the memory of a great age is the most precious treasure that a nation can possess. As the tree is nurtured by its own cast leaves, so it is these dead men and vanished days which may bring out another blossoming of heroes, of rulers, and of sages. I go to Gascony, but my words stay here in your memory, and long after Etienne Gerard is forgotten, a heart may be warmed or a spirit braced by some faint echo of the words that he has spoken. Gentlemen, an old soldier salutes you and bids you farewell. End of section 24, and end of The Adventures of Gerard by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Read by Philip Griffiths.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.